Hello and welcome to Theatre Voice. Over the next 3 years, Eclipse Theatre will attempt a cultural intervention of sorts in a bid to jumpstart the number of black British writers and black British stories on our stages. Funded with an exceptional Arts Council grant, Revolution Mix will commission 9 plays, 2 short films and a series of radio plays, aiming to redress the imbalance of the sorts of stories we tell through drama. Eclipse's artistic director, Dawn Walton, joins me to explain more. Dawn, hello, welcome back to Theatre Voice.
Hey, Matt, how are you?
Very well, thank you. Are you well?
I'm good, yeah.
Good. Let's start by going back to the beginning of Eclipse Theatre Company, mm-hmm. back in 2010. Mm-hmm. Tell me how the company came about and sort of what it grew out of.
Well, interestingly, it sort of coincides with the sort of early part of my career. I trained at the Royal Court Theatre, and I landed there in 2000, 1999 actually was the first, my sort of residency, 1999 through to 2000 was my residency year. And a couple of months into my residency, a newspaper landed on the desk and it said, "Theatre is institutionally racist." I was like, blimey, just got here. What am I thinking? And I mentioned it around, and people sort of shrugged and said, "Oh, you know, we've done this, this, and this play," and you know, the usual kind of things that people say when the subject of diversity comes up. "Oh, no, that doesn't apply to us. We've done this play, this play, this play. What we need to play, etc., etc." And it went on, and it turned out there was a conference going on, which was the Eclipse Conference, which I think was done in Nottingham at the Playhouse. And artistic directors and senior management across the country were invited. To my knowledge, not many went. And there were discussions and the usual people meeting in a room to talk about diversity. But there was one really practical thing that came out of it, I think, and that was the Eclipse Initiative. The initiative had understood that there was zero presence of black work on middle-scale touring. And so there was a formation of a number of theatres into a consortium, and those theatres appointed a producer, who was Stephen Lucky. He was the first one, Stephen Lucky, and they got together and did a tour here, funded by the Arts Council. And I think they did 3 tours. A sort of classic Moon and the Rainbow Shawl. And then I think they did Mother Courage after that, was the second one. And then the third one was Little Sweet Thing, which was a new play by Roy Williams. And they taught them across that network and a number of other theatres. And they went, "Oh, our audiences haven't run away. Maybe there's something in this." They then went again. And I think this time they managed 2 tours. But I think it was getting harder and harder to do. I think, this is me understanding it anecdotally, I wasn't there at that point, it was before my time. The structure of Eclipse, there was no Eclipse in itself, it was an idea more than an actual thing, and it moved from theatre to theatre with a sort of producer figure in place. And I think the programming of it invariably came from the theatre that was hosting it, which may or may not have suited the other consortium. People may have something to say about that, but that's my perception of what I saw. And I arrived, and I think to sort this, they thought, well, maybe we need an artistic director. And I arrived in at the end of 2008, and there was a ready play, which I was weirdly attached to, which was The Hounding of David Oluwole. And at the time, West Yorkshire Playhouse was hosting, so they wanted to tell a lead story. And this story fitted. And my first task was to develop a piece with Oladipo Agboola Adeyemi. wonderful writer, Dippo, as we call him. And I'd admired his work from a distance, but it was a great opportunity to work with him. When I arrived, it was quite interesting, actually. What I observed were two agendas. Mm-hmm. One was the writer's agenda and what he wanted to write, and I think there was another agenda about the story that was felt should be told. I was more interested in what the writer wanted to do, and I felt that was my first task, was to give him a space, make a space around him so he could create the play that he wanted to write. I think there was a desire to create something that was a sort of tribunal play. For those of you that don't know, The Hounding of David Oluwole is the story of a Nigerian man. It's the last case in which the police were culpable in any way of a black death in custody. Since then, there have been literally thousands of, at least a thousand of these deaths. And we can sort of name those as it was. At the time, it was new to me, that story. I didn't know anybody that knew that story, but I thought it was a pretty important story, and I wanted to tell it. What Dippo did, which I thought was wonderful, was took it away from just being a court case, and he told the story, which was much broader, which was about what happens when the ambitions of a city meet the ambitions of a young man, and how that city and all its institutions crush that young man. So it wasn't just about the time of progress, and we looked at the whole history of how modern cities were kind of built with the sort of suburbs, etc. So this is a wonderful document that's really universal across the way. And the best example of it, there was a joke about a ring road. They were celebrating the fact there was going to be a ring road in this new Leeds. And of course, that joke played out brilliantly in every city we went to. So it was a moment of the specifics of the story from the writer's play point, I think translating beautifully into something that is much more universal. So that was that. Having done that, I then set about and talked about what else I wanted to do. And I was very aware that the consortium had a very... They had a desire to... that Eclipse would, I don't know, serve the agenda in terms of their programming. And I was interested more in pushing the programming. So there was a difference. And at that point, I knew that Eclipse wasn't really going to have a future unless it was its own thing. If I can make my own programming decisions. And also, I didn't know any artistic directors in the country that had to talk to 12, you know, five other artistic directors before they could make a decision about what they were going to program. Mm. That's my job, I think. So I wanted it to be independent, and I talked about that. So I set about doing that. I wrote a business plan. I talked to all the people and took all the help that I needed. I started to put a board together, talked to people about perhaps being on the board, etc., etc., and that's what happened. Eclipse was born eventually with an interim period in 2009 when we did a co-production with The Young Vic. A production of Sus, which was wonderful. I'd seen it; it had been on for 8 days, and I wanted to tour that. So, as part of the sort of transition, we did a sort of co-production and toured that. And in that time, I formed Eclipse.
So, what's the company's driving sort of motivation being? What's its company mission statement, as it were?
Eclipse was started in a very simple way. I just wanted it to be about audiences. Mm-hmm. And people had very different ideas about that, but I was clear it was about audiences. And it was about putting on work that engaged regular theatre-going audiences and at the same time brought in new audiences. So to start with, the two core activities was high-quality productions that toured across the sort of middle-scale network. And I used my own relationships to kind of broaden that network. And the second and really important part of it was our audience development. Our audience development was based on, was a nod really to sort of old school tactics and strategy of old fashioned, back in the day, kind of black and Asian touring. It was about relationships with people on the ground level. It was about landing, telling people beforehand, you're touring for a week, you can't build a word of mouth. You can't build a word of mouth while you're, you know, in the week that you're there. You kind of have to do that work beforehand. So it was about building a network of cultural ambassadors, people that understood the work, that were understood the communities, and they would advocate for you. Put those two things together. And I practiced it in Leeds. So I took on Eclipse, the initiative, and then in the evenings after rehearsals, I would go out into the communities and meet people in my own time. And sort of build a network that way. The result of my first time attempting to deliver an audience development programme by myself was a 40% new bookers rate into Leeds West Yorkshire Playhouse. So I knew it worked. Mm. The unfortunate thing was I only got 6 addresses off the end of it, which was a sort of data protection thing. I was like, yeah, I need to do this better. And so we collect data at source, and that's how we've built Eclipse over the years.
And over the 5 years that it's been going, 6 now actually, I should say, there's been a mix of classic plays and new writing. Mm-hmm. Could you tell me a little bit about the programming decision that's had you decide what plays and what playwrights to do and to back?
It's, I wish there was like this really, I mean, it's I think closer now, I've got probably more of a policy, as it were. I'm kind of responding to what's there, really. I kind of, I say Eclipse, when we tour, we want to create high quality work. So sometimes we're raising the profile of a playwright. So One Monkey, Don't Stop, No Show, I did in my first co-production with Sheffield Theatres. That came from my desire to do a comedy. The Hounding of David Oluwole was pretty hard-hitting, as was Sus. And I wanted to do a comedy. And I looked for sort of comedies, and I couldn't really find anything that really had some kind of weight behind it. They were kind of light and ineffectual. I just was uninterested in anything. So one day, out of frustration, I literally Googled the words black comedy. And up came a book called Black Comedies. And it was American plays, but they were all comedies. And the first play in it was this play, which was One Monkey, Don't Stop, No Show. And I read it, and I wet myself, and I was delighted, because it was clearly a restoration comedy, and it had clearly been translated into 1970s black Philadelphia. And I was like, no one ever calls me to do a restoration comedy, and I kind of love them, but you know, I just don't get that call. So I went, this is my restoration comedy, and I'm doing it. That was that.
So where, with the company's sort of programming, how much of it is you as an individual artist, and how much of it has been to this day sort of trying to influence the wider theatre culture?
It's both, really. It's mostly me, isn't it? I mean, I direct most of the pieces, so obviously I have a taste, if you like, and I'm interested in that, and I don't think that's wrong. But also, alongside that, I'm also keen to raise the profile of other artists. So we've toured the work of Burhan Obasisen, who did Sus. We toured Sizwe Bansi, which was Matthew Zia's piece. It's really important to me to tour other artists' work. And sometimes I see stuff in London. I'll go down to London and I'll see stuff. I saw Sizwe Bansi, and it was very clear to me that I immediately, as I watched that show, again, my audiences sing to me. I was like, I could see that playing in Leeds. I know there's an audience for that in Sheffield. They just never get this stuff, and they never see this stuff. I'm going to take it to them because I'm a touring company. I can do that. So it's a combination of those things, really. Something that I feel quite passionate about doing, and something that I can see my audience would love and they never get. Taking Sizwe Bansi to Plymouth was extraordinary. They just never get that work. So it was great for me and great for them.
Why do you think they never get that work? Why is it such a rarity on the touring circuit?
I still think there is. I think there is a fear of perceived risk-taking. It's never a risk, actually, as much as a risk as people think it is, but I think there's still that perception. I think that perception absolutely exists in programming, in the programming level, at the programming level. I think people program what they're comfortable with, what they think will sell. And I think that's, it's so complicated because you're going to talk about what sells, then you're going to talk about, and I will up counter with who's selling it, and so on and so forth. So it's a very complicated conversation in a sense, but I think that at the top strata there's a desire, but that desire doesn't, at the top strata of a theatre there's a desire, but that desire doesn't always go all the way down through the organisation.
Right. And what about the perceived risk of a classic play, classic title, and a piece of new writing? Is there a difference there, or is there, has that kind of been ironed out?
I think new writing is still perceived to be risky. I think you still have to do it, though. Where do the classics come from? I don't know. I think I come from new writing, so I understand it. And that's sort of in my blood, really. And even if I do a classic, I do come from the school of treating it like a piece of new writing. I am that traditional, and I come from that particular school. But I think they're wrong. I think you've got to marry two things. You've got to have work. If you really want to diversify a building, you've got to have work that brings in a diverse audience, and a diverse audience then gives you potential new artists, people that work in your buildings, all the way through. So if you're going to do it, you're going to have to jump off and get on with it. You can't talk about, well, when we can do this, then perhaps we'll go there. Actually, you have to go there now, yeah. You know.
Okay, so build it and they will come.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which brings us very deeply to Revolution Mix, is absolutely that. Yeah. Build it and they will come.
Yeah.
Where did the sort of seeds of it come from? What was the first thinking?
The first play that the Eclipse Initiative did back in 2003 was a play called Moon and the Rainbow Shore. And it's a play that's, some would say not often enough, but it's actually often done. I was quite interested in the history of black theatre in this country and, you know, sort of on the middle scale. What was that? And that's a play that's often done. And it's a beautiful play, and it has wonderful parts, and has space for great performances. And I looked at that play. It comes up on the lists of plays to read and playwriting. When I'm teaching playwriting, etc., it always comes up on that list. And I thought, well, look, where does this play come from? What is the history of this play? And I discovered, almost by accident, or by being a bit of a nerd, that it was actually first produced within 18 months of Look Back in Anger. And I was really shocked when I discovered that, because the legacy, if you like, of Look Back in Anger is for all to see across our TV. But the legacy of Errol John's wonderful play is invisible. I can't see what that legacy is. So I started to pick it apart. I was going, well, is it about actors? Because, of course, at the time, they brought in American actors to do some of those parts and so on and so forth. This was the Observer Play of the Year. Surely this was the beginning of a renaissance. And it wasn't. There are more actors now. Trained actors. Incredible talent. There are more directors, black directors now, than we've ever had before in this country. I don't understand why it's not happening, why that isn't happening. There are more writers now, black writers. I've certainly worked with Ola Enomashiran delivering Critical Mass. The first two, three Critical Masses, David Adai came out of there, Bola came out of that that Critical Mass too. So I know that those writers exist and are out doing stuff. We know about Roy Williams, we know about Debbie Tucker Green. Why isn't that work? Why isn't it embedded in the institution? So that was the seed for me to start to think about what needed to change. And Revolution Mix is where I landed.
So it's that thing of making change that sticks, that gets sort of embedded into organisational.
It's about
cultures.
The legacy of it. So when you have, and this is happening now, when you hear people talking about diversity, and again, I'm finding that word really difficult. I think I prefer the use of the word inclusiveness, genuine inclusiveness. When you start to look for moments of inclusiveness, people start to, apart from the thing I talk about, gathering in rooms and chatting about it, which means they're not doing anything, but to do things, the one thing they definitely do is cross-casting. So cross-casting is always the first thing that people talk about, and I go, well, that's great, and I want to see amazing actors that I know, amazing black actors, playing all kinds of parts. But if that was the solution, then we'd have fixed that in the 50s. Because cross-casting was going on 50s. It was really popular in the 70s. You know, why doesn't it stick? And it's not just about the casting. It's not just about telling, doing a sort of black Shakespeare, sort of the RSC approach, as I recall, which are, again, very welcome, but it doesn't change anything. It's about looking at it across the board. It's about the stories and where black stories sit. And I should define black in this instance. I'm a bit old school, so I mean it in the broadest socio-political sense. It's people of colour, whatever phrase you want to use. We're having a language shift again at the moment, and I really am up for it, but I'm still working that out. But the stories we tell, the black story, the black narrative, is really, when we tell that, really only exists, I realise, in three places. It's a sort of slavery story. It's, and then we kind of disappear out of history, I've said this before, and then we kind of arrive again in this sort of story of a boat arriving in the Windrush. And actually nowadays, there's a sort of the gangsterism, the youth killing each other on the streets. Those are the sort of three main areas. Of course, there are exceptions to this, but those are the three main areas where those narratives sit. And in the institutions, those are the stories they tell. If they tell new stories, those are the stories they've been telling. And I found that really difficult, because I know that we are much broader. The other thing I think that's really important is that stories of a black narrative tend to be about other and otherness. It's about people just arriving, or, you know, the sort of the outsider story, which is not truthful. And I think the Windrush story in particular, I find that really problematic, because it sort of suggests that black people have just got on this island, and therefore we should be jolly grateful for any progress we've made. And I was very, very aware that, you know, black and Asian history in this country goes back some 500 years. So why weren't we telling those stories? And then it occurred to me that actually the missing British stories are all black and Asian.
So this goes back to the Writing the Future report in 2015, the sense that, and it kind of goes back to what you were saying early on about this, about the pressure from the institutions mm-hmm. and the individual artist, the mm-hmm. writer, and how the writer bends to fit what the institution wants.
Or is not included.
Or is not included.
Yeah, yeah.
So I suppose, revolution makes seems to be about opening up a space
yeah.
for the freedom for writers to write the stories they want to tell. Is
yeah.
that right? Okay. So what's the form of it? What's the kind of overarching ambition of Revolution Mix?
Well, the ambition of Revolution Mix is, first of all, to create a body of work that absolutely places the missing black stories back into British history. We are aware of revisionism. We are aware of the arguments that say, you know, the Trevor Nunn thing, you can't have, you know, you can't... I went to a BFI thing just before Christmas, and a guy said, yes, no, we're all about diverse head of... Something BBC was. We're very much about, you know, diversity, etc., etc. Of course, in some, you know, and therefore cross-casting and people, anybody can play any parts, etc., etc. Of course, in some circumstances, we wouldn't be able to do that. This was in November. And when pressed as to what those circumstances was, he said, well, obviously in costume dramas. And he just went, oh my God, we're in the middle of the debate and you're still saying this. Read a book. So... we've got to tackle that. We've got to, I think that's the first thing. And I'm not the only one who's doing it. You know, that you know, in the visual arts world, you know, the work that... once I started doing it, you suddenly start meeting lots of people who are talking in exactly the same way. This idea that people didn't exist, it's weird to have somebody in a costume drama. Oh, my God, there's someone in Downton. Is ludicrous, actually, because there were lots of people. Queen Victoria was... complaining about how many black people there were in the city. She was being very much lobbied to set something up to get rid of black people out of London. There were so many black people per capita, I think is the expression. They're actually seeking to get people out. They're taking our jobs. Does that sound familiar? So we're, you know, why is that history suddenly something else? Why is it as if we're just arriving? You know, it's pretty tough from a girl born in South East London, doesn't know anything else, to kind of hear that you're somehow other all the time. So I'm kind of railing against that, really. And I gather these artists, and they feel the same. The idea is to put the stories back in, and the idea is to tell the stories that, in a way that you are interested in telling those stories, not as a victim of slavery, but actually stories of black agency. We're not seeing those stories.
And I suppose the moment that you hand an individual writer the freedom to take a story that is distinctive in its own thing and handle it in a way that is distinctive, you immediately allow that artist to be an individual artist, to have their voice, in a way that if you're saying, okay, well, you can, if theatre is saying you can write this story, but it has to sort of kind of comply with these frameworks, with these expectations of the story, kind of slots into a general amorphous mass of black work.
Yeah.
And this actually gives these individual 15 writers the chance to really build their own voice and build their reputation as artists.
Yes, it's absolutely. I mean, all my work has always been about raising the profile of black artists. I don't want to, you know, whatever I'm doing, I really don't want to be the only one. I find it quite terrible. That's part of what I'm doing, and I feel that responsibility hugely, actually, to make that happen. But it's a little bit more than that. It's also about the confidence of those artists to grow in a way that they need to grow. But it's also about, in addition to that, is if you constantly dictate what the art is, how is the art going to change? Where are the surprises? Where is the fusion, you know? Jazz funk, you know, indie dance. These are wonderful fusions that gave us whole different types of music. If you keep dictating what it is and you keep it in a particular space, you don't innovate, you change nothing, you're repeating the mistakes, some good, some, you know, that you're repeating history in an uninteresting way. And then put that on top of the fact that actually you're bringing new audiences in at the same time as engaging your regular theatre going. I think we're on a win-win here.
What about the decision to make a body of work? Mm-hmm. Why did that feel important?
Because history says that black artists arrives in ones. So so at the moment I'm touring a Raisin in the Sun, which is Lorraine Hansberry. Lorraine Hansberry's virtually never done in this country. Yet there is a body of artists that even if we just talk about a black American canon, even if we just go black America for the argument, then we tend to do August Wilson and we tend to do James Baldwin. Why? They're amazing is why, but what about the other people? Don Evans, who's the writer of One Monkey Don't Stop No Show, is a direct contemporary of August Wilson. But at the time, August was the man. He was the one that was chosen. And that's how, you know, the institution kind of works. It says, you're the chosen one. We can see your work. Maybe we'll have two, maybe three writers at a time. What's important is to have a body of work happening all at once. We're not going to have one piece and then wait for the bus to arrive. We're going to have lots happening all over the country all at once because there's enough... artists, work, stories for that to happen.
And I suppose at the same time, I mean, this makes me think of something that Tonic Theatre have done recently, this platform series whereby they've commissioned new plays for schools, which again gives people the material to mount their own performances on a local level, on a different level. Presumably these plays will then go off and give other groups material to perform.
Yeah.
And it triggers change
that way. Yeah, absolutely. It was wonderful to watch Red Velvet. When I went to see Red Velvet, it was an incredibly emotional experience to see this one man on his own in the stage amongst all those other characters, and to be sat in the tricycle. I think I saw it on a press night, so I was surrounded by my contemporaries, black artists, all around me, and there we were reaching back over a couple of hundred years, feeling the same. And I thought that was incredible and inspiring. And I want... the reason why people say they can't do black plays, because there aren't any. The reason why I say they don't have new black workers, because there aren't any black writers. And I know they're out there, they just need to be given the opportunity to perform and deliver. So the next generation has a body of work they can pick up.
It kind of, I mean, as a project, just stands as a simple rebuttal to that argument in one go, doesn't it?
It tries to be. I mean, Revolution Mix isn't just about what's on stage. It's about who's in the audience and who gets to see that work. And let's not underestimate the beauty of a mixed audience, people that are mixed between people that go regularly and those that have currently not engaged. It is the most single most beautiful thing. And I learnt this by doing it. So, best example I can give you was watching Suss, actually. And I sat in the audience of Suss, and if you had a kind of traditional audience, for want of a better expression, let's say, an all-white audience, let's call it. Suss is structured in a really interesting way. It's sort of three parts, it's a three acts. The first act, for those of you who don't know Suss, if you don't know Suss, it's a play of a black man having been arrested by two white officers. It's intense, it's a three-hander, and there's quite a lot of tension. You know it's not good, because the Suss laws are the same as Stop on Search. They're not great, it's not great. You think it's not going to end very well.
It's Barry Keith, isn't it?
It's Barry Keith.
When was it written?
This 1979. 1980, but it's set in 1979, which is the night of the election, when they're waiting to hear if Thatcher's coming into power, is when it's set. And that's the setup. Now, what's really extraordinary about the piece is that it's three guys in a room, and there is a lot of banter. So it's joke-ridden at the beginning of the play. People are laughing, they're throwing at, you know, those guys are laughing amongst themselves. They're making gags, the guy's making jokes about how many times he's been picked up and brought in, what is it now, he's not taking it seriously, blah, blah. He's talking about jokes about, something about banana. They're bantering back with him. It's funny. There's sexual, so slightly 70s, kind of slightly misogynistic jokes even in it. It's guys, it's laddish. And it's weirdly funny. It's very funny. And then, of course, it shifts. Now, if you watch it in an all-white audience, because the tension is such that people don't feel like they should laugh at that because they know it's about race, sits at the heart of it, so you probably shouldn't laugh. So there's no permission to laugh. So people are really kind of quite closed and they keep quiet. That was my experience of watching it. They kept quiet. They didn't really laugh at the jokes. So when the shift happens, it's like they've been waiting for it for a long time and there's no real head. When you watched it in a mixed audience, i.e. there's a black audience there as well, then there's a permission to laugh because, of course, we hear the jokes about how many times you've been stopped and searched and we laugh and we enjoy it. And it's a release, in fact, that's what laughter's for. So everybody laughs, everybody's throwing their head, but everybody's relaxed. So when the thing hits, it hits the solar plexus and it really lands. It's devastating having had that journey. That play is very keenly written. And I think it's written in that way. And it is not written for an all-white audience. There's no question in my mind, because that's when it worked the best. It's that I try and do with Eclipse every single time.
So then, coming back to Revolution Mix, tell me about the sorts of writers that you wanted to bring into the project.
So the writers came from, as part of our audience development, every time I do audience development, it's about finding people in communities that are not engaged. And every time I do one of our audience development cultural ambassadors evenings, there would always be writers there. There'd always be black writers. And you'd ask them what their relationship was with their regular, with their theatre, local theatre. They go, I don't have one. You go, okay. And then you go to the theatres and you go, no black work. Do you know any writers? No, we don't. There's no writers. If there was a writer of quality here, we'd know who they were. Okay. And I'm like, there's a mismatch here. They don't know about them. What is going on? How do you not know about people on your doorstep? What is going on in the selection process? Who knows? I don't care to unpick it. But what I do know is that I know those writers And I know that there's theatres that claim to want them, so I'm going to make that work. So that also sits in the middle of Revolution Mix. The writers came from a shout-out I did once I launched Revolution Mix. I simply announced I was looking for writers. Predominantly, I was really looking for writers mostly outside of London, because I knew that was where the need was, and I knew that's where people were most isolated. Artists were most isolated. And we asked for writers who had a level of experience. So they had to have had at least two pieces of work. Theatre, I don't care if they wrote theatre, film, TV, whatever. It had to be at least two pieces of work that had been produced and not really self-produced. I mean, generally, you know, commissioned and produced. And we got nearly 300 applications, which I have to say was quite terrifying to kind of get through them. So I built a team of people, called a team of people, and we filtered through. And got it down to 50. It was also important to me to find people across all five regions. London is a region for me, it's not the focus. Across all five regions, so we want to kind of get that mix. And obviously the gender balance was quite important to me as well. So that's what we did. And I met, Ola Anamashran and I met 50 different writers. We had 50 meetings with 50 writers. In a short period of time, it was exhausting, but we did it, and out of that selected the final group. It's slightly a casting process, so you're looking for people that partly that you think will get on, that will mix, because it was also a casting process. People had to work in a room together, and they're going to be taking a 3-year journey. So there's about, there's a little bit of personality thing that, I don't know. I'm a director. I think I'm excellent at casting. So there's a bit of that as well. But it's a mixture of people who've written radio, some are write TV, some are theatre makers, and so on and so forth. That's who I found.
It's an interesting sort of, I was really intrigued by the sort of different backgrounds in terms of their forms, their kind of styles.
Mm-hmm.
And it struck me that that's going to be an extraordinary asset to bring those people together.
It's awesome.
Like, the ability for them to sit in a room and kind of swap stories, swap forms.
Yeah.
Really, really.
It's really, really good because they have different skills. They have different skills. So, for example, the people that come from TV are extraordinarily good at kind of laying out a story. They can follow a story all the way through and plan it completely, which, of course, in theatre, less so. You know, it's a little bit yoggetier. It's a little bit more, I'll discover what it is as I go. And so that mix-mashing of ideas, you know, people that come from more music backgrounds will take something from here, take something there, and the fusion of it. I think it's really interesting how they feed each other. But the most important thing about that group of people is how empowered they are by being part of a group. About being Revolution Mix writers. They were quite bruised. They'd had some terrible experiences, some of those people. It's shocking, even to me, who's had terrible experiences herself. It's always shocking to me how much, when you collect that, a group of black artists in a room, the stories that we get to share from this institution, you know, that we've experienced in these institutions, it's terrible. And actually, there is something really wonderful about how they talk to each other, how they go, somebody said this to me the other day, is that normal? No, that's not normal, and that's not nice. And you can see the emails flying back and forth. It's wonderful. It's really, really great for them to have that network of people.
Mm. And what about the network of theatres that you're working with? How
yep.
did that come about? And what's the importance of it being nationwide for you?
It's important to be nationwide because, well, we're everywhere. Black people are everywhere. There's no part of the country where you can even say there is nobody. It's just a fact of how the nation has developed. And, you know, despite what some TV programmers may think. The network, the theatres at the moment really come from my relationships, I guess. Eclipse has relationships with theatres up and down the country, so we went out and talked to some of them. And some of them are immediate partners, and some of them will be partners, and some of them will take the tours. So that's an ever-growing list of people that are part of Revolution Mix, really, because the initial partnerships are currently supporting the writers, the commissioned work, in developing that piece and embracing them into buildings. But the second strand of people will be co-producers, because this is all have to be done through co-producing, and we'll be part of those co-producing models. So it's important that anybody that really wants to be part of Revolution Mix just steps up and comes and be part of it. Also, there's different sizes of work. So some theatres, we really want to work with them, but they have a very large space and they have a very small space. So as middle-scale tours, we don't fit, but they'll take small-scale. And that's a really wonderful thing to be part of it, because we can then deliver our audience development in those areas, because you have to do that with an audience.
Looking ahead to 2018, what would you like Revolution Mix to have achieved?
I would like to have a body of work that has come from the Black British experience that can be, as you say, a legacy body of work that has enriched the canon of British theatre. That's my big, bold, arrogant statement about the actual work. But I think that's a real possibility with the talent that we have. I would like also to have achieved, we're training a number of audience development officers across the UK who are local to the theatres, and then we're leaving them there. We're going to train them. They're going to deliver the audience development across their own cultural ambassador networks in all the cities that we're touring to. And we're going to leave those people there. So I'd like to think that we've impacted somewhat on workforce in terms of the people that if those theatres don't use those people, then there's something else going on. Because why wouldn't you use people that can walk people into your building? The third thing would be that all those theatres have a list of writers that they can absolutely call up and have a relationship with. And over the course of Revolution Mix, we want all the theatres that are part of it to have a relationship with all of our writers. I never really want to hear again, we don't know any. That's the sort of legacy of it, really. The idea that you don't know any artists or don't know any Black artists is quite abhorrent to me. And then, of course, we're looking also at the workforce in these buildings. They tend to be predominantly white workforce in an ever-changing environment where people are not all white outside, it seems to me. We're in Sheffield. It's simply not... It doesn't make any sense. So I'd like to think that some of those audiences feel inspired to get involved. You know, workforces come from audiences. That's the first relationship, really. So I'd like to think that some of those people will eventually become part of those buildings in other forms, in other roles, in other jobs. And it might not be that you're on stage or working in technical, but actually if you're an accountant and you're creative, I'd like to think you could work in a building like this. If you're, you know, in development or in, you know, in administrative roles, I don't know why these buildings are not completely representative of the cities that they represent.
That's the last question. Mm-hmm. It's probably one that might have come a bit earlier, but why now?
I think that the whole question of inclusiveness is absolutely coming to a head. I think, unlike any other time, I think one thing that's really important is the creative case. I don't think we should negate, for me, the importance of the speeches and the leadership from the Arts Council. They've been really clear about it. And I think the reason why it hasn't stuck, one of the things it hasn't stuck before is because there's been no consequences for not doing it. You can just kind of do it or not do it. You can sign up or not sign up. And I think there are real consequences. I hope it's real. I don't know yet, but it looks like it. I thought when I saw that league table about about workforce. I was like, this is real. This is good. People were ringing me. People were twitching. People were thinking about it. People had the conversation. It's not about beating people. It's just like, have the conversation. Keep it on the table. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, I think once upon a time, we didn't have the information. We didn't have the data. We didn't know what the population was. We didn't know these things. Now, I know this stuff because I'm on my phone. My 8-year-old nephew knows it because he can Google it up on his phone or on his little on his tablet. He hasn't got a phone.
So it becomes completely not.
So you cannot deny it. You can't deny it because the data is out there and it's available. And I think people are impatient. We've been through this loop a load of times. It's really boring. I don't want to talk about it. I just want to get on with it, really. We've never had such talented, amazing people on this road. And the discussion is broad and it's universal. It's going right across to Hollywood. We're seeing TV across the world. We're going, hang on, how's Shonda Rhimes existing? What have we got? We want that. We're not dependent on 4 channels or 3 or 4 channels anymore and our local theatre. We can go anywhere and see anything. So, you know, and there's a thing called YouTube. You know, if I don't see it on stage, I'm going to watch it on YouTube. So sort it out. Otherwise, you're just behind. You're irrelevant.
John Walton, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.